Today's program has been brought to you by the International Culinary Center, offering courses that range from classic French techniques in culinary, pastry, and bread baking to Italian studies to management, from culinary technology to food writing, from cake making to wine tasting. For more information, visit internationalculinarycenter.com. You're listening to Heritage Radio Network, broadcasting live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. If you like this program, visit heritageradionetwork.org for thousands more.
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live from Roberta's Pizzeria in Bushwick, Brooklyn. Joined as usual with Nastasha the Hammer Lopez. We got Jack and Joe in the engineering booth. How's everyone doing?
See what happens when you miss 2 weeks. Can't even do the intro.
I missed 1 week.
Oh yeah.
Well, but you know, of course, you're going to trip up on the word host. I scared literally like these guys like at the there's a table that sits right by the radio window, and they're like, "What the?" And they're gone. Calling to questions 2-718-497-2128. That's 718-497-2128. And I haven't said this in a while, but remember, you can call us with pretty much any question, right, guys? I mean, it doesn't have to be technical. I mean, usually is, but Nastasha, speaking of technical, right now. This is like a very meta Nastasha moment. She's reading, as we said, she noticed because she looks at things, believe it or not. They have a book that was shipped in to us, the radio station, called The Vegan Stoner Cookbook. So Nastasha is going to
They have a definition of the vegan stoner, which is one who satisfies the munchies with resourceful, creative, instinctive cooking without using animal products.
Wait, say that again?
One who satisfies the munchies with resourceful, creative, instinctive cooking without using animal products.
Are you? Can you do instinctive things when you're stoned out of your mind? Or is it pretty? I'm not a stoner, but most of my friends who hit up quite a lot, they don't necessarily make their best cooking decisions when they're stoned out of their mind. Just saying.
And all their fruits and vegetables have a stoner face going on in this?
Yeah. Well, you know, look, hopefully pretty soon. I mean, I have some friends who are kind of very deep into cooking and making liquor products with cannabis. And, you know, maybe soon it'll be legal for me to work on those things as well. But, I've never really tried that stuff out. She's looking at these vegetables.
I told you.
The vegetables in the book are quite. They look. It's not Nastasha's vegan face. I'll tell you that.
These guys are really relaxed.
That's a much different vegan face.
Different vegan face. Their eyes are all at half mast. It's pretty. Yeah.
I predict at least 3 write-ins or call-ins related to this subject now.
I hope so.
We'll see.
Well, why don't you call out the authors of the book here? We don't know these people.
We got a call coming in right now. Hold on.
Hello, caller. You're on the air.
Hi, this is John Doe calling in to speak to Dave.
How you doing? It's me. It's Dave. What's up?
Hey, what's up?
Nothing.
Online?
Yeah, we're on air. By the way, John Doe, big help at the Puff Party event that we had last Tuesday. I thought a big success. Didn't you think so?
Yeah, it looks awesome. It was really cool to be able to puff the stuff I brought as well and learn everything all about the puffing gun and the moisture tester and all that stuff. It was a blast.
Your mix of it was teff. It was teff, tapioca. What was the third?
And millet.
Millet, man, that was the best puff we had of the evening. I thought that stuff was delicious. Although later, by the way, for those who don't know what we're talking about an explosive puffing gun that the Museum of Food and Drink has as their first kind of temporary exhibit. And John Doe came and. Puffed a bunch of stuff with us, including that mix I just told you about, and it was the best, by far, far and away the best. So then when we did the Saturday public event, we got some tapioca pearls and puffed them just on their own, and they turned into giant, like cumulus cloud styro balls. It was the weirdest thing ever. It was not as good, the tapioca, when we did it without the full mix of stuff. Really interesting.
Yeah, that's awesome.
Yeah.
So, kind of wanted to call the follow up and give you guys a shout out, especially Piper and Nastasha for showing me such hospitality. And also, I headed over to BDX and got some rye drinks from Nick, and he cooked me up some pretty amazing stuff.
Nice.
But I also had some questions. Kind of wanted to follow up on suggestions for puffing. We had talked, Piper and I kind of concocted some possibility of throwing some cocoa nibs in with some rice to be able to make, you know, cocoa puffs, auto cocoa puffs. I was just wondering what your thoughts on that.
Well, I mean, my feeling is, like, when we put things in that are weird, like, for instance, the last puff of the day that we did on Saturday, we threw in almonds and...
Lobster. Lobster shells.
No, that was on the party day. And then sunflower seeds and a bunch of stuff. Didn't puff. I don't know that cocoa... I'd have to look up cocoa nibs. My strong feeling is something that high in oil will tend to melt out. I mean, I know... Maybe not, though, in the lack of water. I mean, we'll try it someday, but as you say, we'll try it in an absence of in with a multitude of other stuff so that it's the minor constituent. This way, if it goes horribly wrong, the horrible wrongness can be absorbed by the rest of the batch and not all over the inside of the gun. Like, we notice that when we make mistakes, the mistakes tend to melt themselves onto the inside of the gun and then require kind of a bit of a hardcore cleaning. That happened in one of our tapioca batches, actually. We had to run a clean mid-event on Saturday because the tapioca completely melted itself to the inside. And when it's melted and open, it carburizes very quickly but doesn't solidify fast enough to flake it off. And so you get this kind of sludge in the gun, but more. And again, I couldn't find our green coffee because I know I want to puff green coffee as well. But a lot of it has to do with the starch content.
Sweet Maria's, I don't know if you know, but Sweet Maria's has a pretty cool site. It pretty much, you know, breaks everything down. It's a ridiculous information gathering site for anybody who wants to roast coffee.
Yeah, I used to buy my green beans from them. But back when I used to roast my own all the time. It was, you know, for years that was my ritual. That I used to buy beans from them. Yeah.
Okay, cool. I just had a side question on a project I'm working on. I'm trying to make fish sauce bacon, and, you know, basically I've been, you know, doing the standard dry cure plus adding a little bit of fish sauce. I can't seem to get enough fish sauce bump into it. I mean, I can kind of feel that there's extra umami, but I want to really juice it up. And I was thinking about doing, you know, basically boiling off the liquid and creating, you know, creating a fish salt to do the curing process and add the nitrates afterwards.
Right.
And I'm wondering if I'm going to lose anything in terms of flavor when I do that. And obviously, I don't have a rotary evaporator, but just wondering what you had in terms of thoughts on that.
Yeah, you're going to lose a lot. I mean, like, look, you're going to lose a lot anyway on the cook-off of the bacon, right? But,
right.
I mean, so much of fish sauce – I mean, look, fish sauce is a couple of different things. It's salty, right? It's high in umami because of protein and lipid breakdown product. Well, not umami, not because of lipid, but protein breakdown products. But it also got a lipid breakdown products in there, right? And so, but it has a huge volatile component as well. So my feeling is you'll be able to get, you know, a lot of the more stable stuff in there, but you're going to lose a lot of the volatile characteristics of it. I don't know what the salt content of a standard fish sauce is, but they're widely variant depending on brand. I remember that from my research years ago. You don't want to you don't want the high liquids content. Is that the problem?
I like the fact that when you dry cure, it stays flat and you don't lose a lot of liquid. I mean, I realized that I could do an injection method like they do in industry, so I could try that too, right?
Well, I mean, what you could do is you could dry it, right, and then you could just have – you could – sorry, you're right, inject it wet, but then just go through a little bit of a relatively high humidity dry down period in the fridge before you smoke it out. You know what I'm saying?
Okay. Yeah.
Flash off some of the extra moisture that you put into it by injecting. But my feeling is that if you really want that flavor of fish sauce, which, you know, some people, they don't like the smell of it, but they're just mistaken. This, you know, the stuff is delicious. If you want that, then, you know, I would go with – I would use very little else because my guess – I mean, it depends on the fish sauce you use, but it's probably pretty close to what you need, right?
Okay.
I mean, is it? I got to remember the percentages of it, but then, and then just let a little bit of the moisture flash off under controlled conditions of temperature for a while prior to smoke down.
Okay, sounds good. So just as a closeout, I was wondering if you had a chance to try the IPA I dropped off at BDX.
I haven't. I'm going there tonight. I'm going to hopefully get a hold of it tonight, and we'll give you a shout-out next week.
Awesome. Well, that's if it's, well, let me know if it's good or bad. We thought it came out pretty good.
All right. Well, so, what was your initial gravity on that?
All right. Cheers.
Wait, wait. What was the OG on the IPA? What was the OG? What was the specific gravity on the wort? Do you remember?
We didn't really go through that whole process. We were kind of drinking and smoking things in terms of meat.
Right.
So we were just kind of doing a quick brew, so we didn't pay attention too much to that stuff.
Smoking meats, not smoking what the vegan stoner is smoking, presumably.
Exactly.
Yeah. All right. All right. Well, we'll let you know what happens.
All right. Cheers.
All right, cheers. Thanks for calling in. Okay. Oh, by the way, back to the vegan stoner thing. Did you see the? Were you watching the CNN Sanjay Gupta's weed thing?
No.
You seen that?
Oh yeah, I saw that.
You saw? I thought I was really interested by that.
Why don't you give a synopsis? For those of us who did not watch it.
Well, the synopsis is that, remember when Peter Tosh said legalize marijuana in a Jamaica? You remember this? He has a song. He has several songs actually on the subject, but you know, it goes through the medicinal benefits of marijuana, and turns out that it's probably true. You know. Anyway, so Landon Young writes in on the Twitter. He's at Food Geeky. Cooking issues, planning a Vitamix versus the competition blend off. What tasks would show off slash reveal the blender's strengths and weaknesses? I like that it's Vitamix versus everybody else. Now listen, here's the deal. There's a couple of things that are hard to judge. And I remember, I think it was, I forget who it was. It was either Consumer Reports or what's the one that from Boston, the magazine from Boston. I was an initial subscriber. Cooks Illustrated I had the charter issues of that.
That's awesome.
Yeah, it's good. It was, you know, anyway, strong. But the point is that people often do the wrong things with blenders and don't really show off why VitaPrep is such a piece of butt kicking machinery. Right now. For instance, most of the time when people review it, they're like, does it make a smoothie as fast as some of the other blenders? Is it smoothie? Nobody cares. In a kitchen, a professional kitchen, nobody cares about a smoothie, right? What was it? What?
You have a caller.
Oh, all right. We'll get back to the blenders in a second. Caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave and everyone else. I just wanted to call in and ask a little more information about Ikajime.
Oh, nice.
Which I understand a little bit about. I know it's a process of, you know, killing fish and inserting rods into their spinal cord to prevent or, I guess, kind of delay rigor mortis. But
right.
What is the real reason people do it? I guess I've heard, like, firmer flesh, but, like, what are the upsides and downsides? And okay. Why don't more people do?
Okay. That excellent questions. By the way, you want to call out your name or no?
Oh, hi, I'm Kate.
Hey, Kate. So the first of all, Ikajime in general is the whole battery of Japanese fish killing techniques. Okay, and then the specific technique of destroying the spinal cord is they've told me is called Shinkenuki, which means like no spine, I think, right? And it involves running a wire up the spinal cord. So all the Japanese fish killing techniques are designed, whether or not you believe they work or not, are designed to increase the quality of the fish flesh. I've noticed it most pronounced in the firmness, in the texture of the fish, although there are some taste differences we've noticed as well. And also the, you know, we have found that it makes more of a difference in raw prepped as opposed to cooked prepped, although some people disagree with me. But that's what it is. But the idea is this, in a nutshell, is that the standard Western style killing technique of just whacking it something over the head or bleeding it out while it's alive or letting it suffocate to death in a well of a boat it puts a lot of stress on the fish as it's dying, and the stress from the fish dying, whether it's, you know, because of hypoxia because it doesn't have enough oxygen, or whether it's you know, blunt trauma and bleed out, all this stuff, or you know, just you know, whatever's pumping through the fish's system as it's in its fight or flight mode, all of those things have deleterious qualities on the quality of the flesh from an eating standpoint. Now, the ikijime, especially the spinal cord destruction, right? So ikijime starts with severing the brain's connection to the rest of the fish, right? So you're shutting off all of the transmissions from the brain to the muscles of the fish, and presumably, therefore, shutting off the ability of the dying fish brain to make changes to its body chemistry. Now, the way that I was taught originally was just to sever the spinal cord, but on larger fish, I really think it's a better idea to, and they make these special curved knives, that you actually take out the brain of the fish prior to severing the spinal cord, right? Now, when you sever the spinal cord, the spinal cord severing, it both at the tail and at the front, is also a bleeding technique because, you know, the belief in Japan, and I think, you know, pretty much borne out, that you want to get most of the blood out. And by severing the arteries near the head and at the tail, you get a fairly efficient pump out of blood into water. So that's why you'll see in these techniques the fish will be cut and then bled in water often to get most of the salt water, usually isotonic, hopefully, to the fish's blood system, pump out the blood to get a well-bled fish. Okay, now, so then the real question is, and it seems fairly easy to understand that you're going to influence the quality of the fish flesh by quickly killing the brain or severing the spinal cord. The interesting question is this extra step of shoving a wire up the spinal cord. Well, what the hell can that accomplish, right?
Right.
Well, turns out that the spinal cord continues to send electrical impulses to the muscles, even in the absence of central nervous system control from the brain. So what happens is that if you don't destroy the spinal cord, especially in very kind of long swimming, like pelagic style fish, like tuna, striped bass, these kinds of things. The spinal cord will continue to send messages to the muscle to contract, and therefore the muscles will use more ATP, which is the energy store of the muscle, than they will if you destroy the spinal cord. And the faster the ATP is used up, the faster the fish goes into rigor mortis, and usually the harder the fish goes into rigor mortis. And fish flesh is so delicate that hard rigor can actually do damage, such that when it comes out of rigor mortis, that fish is it starts having gaping in the flesh. The flesh is softer, not as firm as it would be had you delayed rigor mortis. And so that's kind of those are the overarching reasons for the techniques.
Okay. And I guess, is it primarily, the texture, but also, like, is it so people can keep the fish longer or something? Like, can that,
So what we used to call Western-style fish killing when we did it was, you know, it does deteriorate more quickly, but the interesting thing about ikijime, look, fish actually isn't best the second you catch it, regardless of what anyone's going to tell you. Very few preparations taste good there's whole nations of people with billions of people that will disagree with me on this. But, you know, most of us in either a Japanese-style preparation, most Japanese-style preparations, or in a Western-style preparation, prefer a fish that's come out of rigor mortis, right? And everybody knows you have to either eat the fish before it goes into rigor, which means instantaneously after death you have to cook it, or you have to wait for it to go through rigor. And even if you do it before rigor sets in, it's still going to be a lot firmer and almost crunchy for a lot of preparations. And you can use that to your advantage. But you really kind of want the fish to come out of rigor. So it's true that when you have something that has had the spinal cord destroyed, it takes longer for it to come out of rigor. So its optimum eating point usually happens after the optimum eating point of a standard Western-style killed fish. But that fish at its best is usually, for the ones where it responds well to this technique, is usually at its best, is usually much better than the Western style variant, and the Western style variant will get softer and mushier much faster than the spinal cord ablated one will. And as to your other question, I didn't answer, which is why don't more people do it? Well, part of it is education, and part of it is high cost.
Right.
You know, and the other thing is that you know if you take a fish and you pull it on a boat and it's had a huge fight, right? It's already gone through a lot of the problems that are going to cause it to, you know, it's exhausted most of its ATP. It's it's gone through a lot already, and so the benefits might be marginal at that point. You know, when they're killing a very high value fish like tuna, especially in farm situations, they will electro stun so the fish doesn't know anything that's happening, pull it up on deck and put the spinal cord do the spinal cord ablation because they know that the market value of the fish is so high.
Right.
You know, there's also experiments in Australia, New Zealand. Well, they're not experiments, they're commercial, where in New Zealand you're allowed to use fish anesthetic, aquiesce, which is based on clove oil, isoeugenol, and they use that to anesthetize the fish prior to bleed out because they've seen that a less afraid or less, you know, whatever you want to call, you know, what's going on in the fish's brain prior to slaughter, is if there's less of that going on, that the quality is better. And so those guys, it's not approved, or at least wasn't last time I looked here in the U.S., strangely, but it's an ongoing area of research, and most of it's right. driven by economics.
Cool. I guess that explains it. I just heard the term recently and looked it up and thought I should call and ask.
Yeah, well, please. I love it. I haven't had the opportunity to do a lot of experimenting with it recently. My hope was always that the more we bring attention to it as a technique, the more fish sellers will start to demand this process boat side and then demand a premium price for it. And then if people start calling it out, then you'll see more of it in the marketplace, especially for things
right.
that we intend to eat as sushi grade. And so it's the idea isn't that most of us are ever going to practice it, or that restaurant wise you should practice it, because by the time a live fish makes it to a restaurant, it's been pretty abused usually. You know what
yeah.
I mean? The idea is to have people accept the benefits of the practice and pay more for it, and then it'll happen more. I think.
Great.
Cool.
All right. Well, thank you.
Thanks Very for calling much. In. All right, so back to the VitaPrep. So,
how about a quick break?
All right. We'll take a quick break.
And before
right
the quick break, what? Wait, we got to shout out Chris Hubing, who became a member, listener of Cooking Issues. Thanks for the support.
Thank you. We're coming back with Cooking Issues.
The National Culinary Center is a proud sponsor of the HeritageRadioNetwork.org. The ICC, with locations in New York and California, provide cutting-edge education to future chefs, restaurateurs, and wine professionals. We're proud to claim Dan Barber, Bobby Flay, and David Chang among our honored alumni. This is Dorothy Cann Hamilton from Chef Story. Check out our ICC website at internationalculinarycenter.com.
Jack, is that your magical Zamfir stuff in the background?
Oh yeah.
Wee-lee-lee-lee-lee-lee-lee. I like that. It's like, you know, space center. It's like music NASA would play.
Yeah, planetarium music basically. Yeah.
Yeah, I like that. All right, good. All right.
For vegan stoners.
Vegan stoners planetarium ICC music?
Exactly.
I would love to see Dorothy stoned out of her mind.
Oh wow.
Debbie. Did I say that on air?
Yeah.
Anyway. All right. Apparently we have a caller. Caller, you're on the air.
Yeah, hi. Patrick calling from Orient, New York.
Ooh, where's Orient, New York? I think I've been there. Where is it?
It's at the very, very tip of the North Fork of Long Island.
No, I haven't been there. So I'm thinking of Maine. There's Norient, Maine I've been to. Go ahead.
So I have a question about canning or really preserving fish in oil in jars.
Okay.
I've been trying it without fully curing the fish, just salting it lightly overnight in the refrigerator, then barely cooking it in water, and then covering it in oil. And this way I know it's not fully cured, it's not really safe to have it at room temperature, but it seems to last like a week or two in the fridge without any ill effects.
Right.
And it tastes really, really good, even if you just use a neutral cooking oil. The question I have is, now I have access to a huge amount of bluefish out here that I sort of would like to make a lot of this before the season ends, and I'm wondering if it's suicidal to use this method, you know, without doing the full, you know, boil for 3 hours, pressure can, et cetera, that's sort of the traditional fish preservation technique.
Right. That's a very interesting question. And, you know, I can't make any offhand I'll say this. If you add nitrites to it, right, I don't know if you want to, but, you know, look, everyone knows what we're talking about here. We're worried about botulism, right? And other kind of – there are some other, especially in fish actually, some cold-tolerant spore-forming pathogens, I'm pretty sure. It's been a while since I've looked up this process. But fish keeping is a whole science in of itself, and people definitely remember preserve things for long periods, think lox, in a fridge environment that haven't been cooked to hell, right? But I believe you're going to want to add – there's a couple things you need to know. You need to know what the moisture content of it is. And you need to know how much salt you're going to add. And then you're going to want to add, I would guess, for safety's sake, some nitrites to it. And if you if you get the right combination of that, and I'm sure this is lookupable on the web, then as long as you aren't going to store it at room temperature, if you're going to keep it refrigerated, you could probably make a safe product that's fairly close to what you're doing. It's not going to be shelf stable. It's not canned, but
yeah.
you could probably make something that will inhibit the growth of the kind of really nasty stuff in the fridge. But I'm hesitant to give you any actual numerical recommendations over the air without doing a lot of research first.
I was looking up traditional recipes, and these sort of, you know, they have you cook the hell out of the fish for, like, you know, for a long period and then can it that. So I guess, you know, that will destroy the texture of the fish. I mean, I don't have access to a canner where I am in the first place.
Right.
But it seems like that the best flavor on the small-scale experiments I've done have been on stuff that's not – it doesn't feel fully cured once it's out, you know, out of the salt. It sort of it has the texture, slight texture, still fresh fish. So it seems to be that's what I'm sort of worried about, is that the best flavor is not something that's going to be safe at the cure level with the amount of salt and like you said, adding nitrite to it as well.
Right. Well, remember, the cooking itself isn't obliterating the really dangerous stuff. It's obliterating the normal stuff. It's the canning that obliterates the normal stuff. And the reason that you probably have to cook the crap out of it first is because you're probably getting rid of water at that point. You're lowering the water activity through a cooking. I mean, think about how confit works, you know?
Mm-hmm.
You do a long cook on it, and the meat is salty and dry. You know what I mean? In a good way. I mean, I happen to love confit. But you know, you're like, the cook step isn't just a cook step. It's also a water control measure.
Mm-hmm.
Although you could do a straight pressure can of the fish without the initial cook step after the curing and get a higher moisture, but it's still going to be – you're going to be cooking the hell out of it. It's going to be different from what you want. I would
– I mean, the other thought I had is this something that once you cover it in oil and let it – you know, I don't know. The flavor has pretty much been the same over, you know, one day versus 14 days in the fridge. So it seems to not really age that much after the cure and the cooking. Is this something that you could actually put in the freezer covered in oil and safely?
Yeah,
and,
well, if
and
you,
do you
freeze,
think it would come out intact?
Intact-ish. You know, you're better off probably doing it after the – freezing it after the full step –
Yeah,
botulism shouldn't grow in the freezer.
Yeah,
you know what I mean? It should not grow in the freezer.
because I'm willing to take the, you know, the experimental loss of, you know, a couple giant bluefish, you know, in the greater interest of flavor here, because they're so cheap here. They're like $2 a pound for,
really?
You know,
I love bluefish.
An 8 pound fish. So.
I really love bluefish. Just grilled, anything. I really love bluefish. Bluefish is really delicious. Yeah, freezing, nothing should grow. Again, double check everything. Nothing of import should grow in the freezer. Remember that I've never actually put a liquid oil pack in the freezer before. Most times when you age oil canned fish, they're aging for years. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So, like, you know, a lot of those changes, especially in the canned, you know, hermetically canned stuff, you're talking about years of changes, not, you know, days or weeks. You know, and in confit, when you age it even, it's like, you know, like a month or more when you age like a duck confit, which I love that aged duck confit flavor. But I feel fairly comfortable that if you freeze it, you're going to be in a safe zone. But I've never frozen a packed product in a liquid fat before. I've only frozen them in a solid pack. Remember, when you freeze, freezing actually can accelerate rancidity of things because the water fraction that's there is more concentrated, and so you can have things go rancid pretty hardcore in the freezer. If there's any oxygen. So you're going to want to really pack that stuff without any air at all.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, obviously, okay. It's covered in oil, so it's going to be less of a problem, but you want to get all the air out of the bag.
Yeah. And you think just something like canola oil would freeze it? I mean, I've frozen, you know, like you said, solid fat pretty well, but I just never, you know, it never really comes up of freezing,
yeah.
Freezing liquid fat.
I mean, most of your liquid fats have been winterized, so they're not going to freeze at all. Do you know what I mean? In the freezer. I mean, I would guess that canola is completely winterized and won't go solid, although I've never put it in the freezer. I mean, olive oil gets sludgy, right?
Yeah.
And also tastes good, but the costs more. But the, canola, my guess is that canola will stay. I don't remember what temperature canola starts getting sludgy, because it's been a long time since I've, like, you know, tried to... I've done cold oil spherification of agar with something like grapeseed, but, you know, so it's been a long time since I've tested the limits of sludginess of those oils. But they're all winterized, so they shouldn't probably get too solid in the freezer.
But it's still, it's just the temperature and not the consistency that matters from the food safety standpoint.
Yes, that is my guess. That is my educated guess, yes. That is the temperature.
Well, I have this duck fat out here, too, that maybe I can put the fish in there.
Without
trying to really... you know, combination of species experiment.
I don't know. I like that. Remember, like, there's that famous the famous Chinese dish called Happy Family, where it's like all different kinds of animals put together.
No, that Noah's Ark would be the translation.
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'm going to start this experiment. I'll report back.
Yeah, please do. Let us know
how
it goes.
Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, then. Bye bye.
Orient, New York. You ever been there, Stas? You've been out to the tip.
Yeah, no, we're not there though. No. Have you?
No. All right, listen, I'm going to get through this Vita Prep thing now. All right? Now, we're talking about Vita Preps versus other blenders. There's two things. There's one, there's ultimate blending ability, right? And other blenders, the BlendTech, for instance, have, you know, very good blending capabilities. And there's another one I saw that's a lot cheaper than a Vita Prep that actually has, I think, is blade interchangeable with the Vita Prep, called the Omni Blender. Also has a 3-horsepower motor. Omni Blender. Anyway, it has a 3-horsepower motor and like a really kind of like a good looking blade, actually. In fact, it looks like the blade might be superior to Vita Preps. I'm not sure. But, and it's a lot cheaper. But when you look at the controls for it, you realize that one of the reasons that cooks love Vita Preps is not based on, you know, making fruit smoothies. It's the control mechanisms of Vita Preps are amazing. Two paddle switches and a knob. Very intuitive, very good for cooks. So any rating of professional quality blenders has to take into account what it's like to use them when you're cooking, you know, especially when you're cooking heavy duty in a kitchen over long periods, and you need it to have a good touch, a good feel. And I think one of the reasons, other than blending ability, that we all love the Vita Prep so much is the way that it becomes an extension of your hands. The thing we hate about it is that if you lose the plunger, which cooks invariably lose the freaking plunger, you have to beat on it to get it to blend properly. Although they have a new pitcher that apparently is much better in that regard, closer to what the BlendTech pitcher is like. Here are some things to test out. Can you blend a pound of bacon into a tomato sauce and have it be silky smooth? Right? That's a good test. Other things like that. I mean, what's interesting about the Vita Prep isn't that you can make a smoothie with it. What's interesting about it is that you no longer need to use a Tammy when you're making sauces because the Vita Prep can make things that smooth. So those are the things that you want to test. And then if you absolutely need to, you can see whether or not it makes a decent margarita, right? Yeah. Although I do like myself a frozen margarita.
Me too.
Stuff tastes good. I mean, you know what the thing is? People like some stuff that you grew up with, yeah, it's de classe, stuff delicious. Delicious. You know, it's like I'm sick of people hating on things that are common if they taste good. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I'm sick with that. Anyway, Aaron Marin from Edmonton, Canada. Edmonton, Alberta, Canada, by the way. Calls in about cooling. Hey, all. Just had a quick question about super cooling with a circulator. I seem to remember Dave briefly touching on the topic using the circulator to speed along the chilling process post-cooking. This got me thinking, can I drop my water bath below freezing without destroying my wonderful circulator? I've noticed it goes below freezing, but I'm too scared to drop it down out of fear of destroying my baby. I think of putting unopened bottles of water in the bath for an hour or so. Should I put some ice or salt in there as well? I have an old school Polyscience 7306 model. That's this old stainless bottom one, the old one. That's Staz's favorite. She had her happy face on there. Could I do it with other models? Should I protect the bottles so they're not being knocked around in the icy bath? Thanks in advance. Aaron Moran from Edmonton, Alberta. P.S. Can you answer this on the next show? Because I'm waiting to do this technique on a dinner party on Saturday. Okay, look it. Lookity look. I use this technique all the time with my circulator. That circulator, if my memory serves me, can go down to about minus 20 Celsius. That's the lowest I've ever taken. I don't know if it goes below that. I meant to test it in the newer plastic one before I came in, but I forgot. I forgot to test it, whether or not that thing can be set below zero. But, yeah, so here's what you do. And I do this all the time at events where I want to chill down large batches of cocktails. This is one of my favorite cocktail chilling techniques for events because it's fairly accurate. You get a big tray, you fill it with vodka, cheap vodka, and then you throw dry ice into it. And then you set the circulator in on high circulation and you set it to whatever you want your cocktail temperature to be, right? And then you just let it run, and what happens is, As the dry ice chills it below your set point, the heater will come on and will heat the vodka back up to the temperature you want it to be. And then as you notice that the dry ice is almost gone, you break off a couple more chips of dry ice and you throw it in. And you can keep a very accurate temperature on drinks for hours. And this is my favorite way to do carbonated batch or to hold like large batch cocktails for long periods of time. And I've done it many, 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 many times, and I've never hurt the circulator, not once. You could probably also do it with salt water. Be aware that you might eventually pit or corrode the 316 stainless that is on it with large amounts of salt. But salt water baths can be controlled just on a salt ice basis. You know, you might not need the circulator. You might need the circulator, but you might not need the heating effect. I typically use dry ice. That's the way I do it. Okay. John Riper writes in about peaches. That's apropos, right? The name Riper Peaches. Good, right? Yeah. Dear Cooking Issues Peace, Pacific Northwest food guru. By the way, you like tongue twisters?
No. Go ahead. Do it.
Willie's.
No, you did it last time, actually.
What? I did?
You said it, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Anyway, I can't tongue twisters. Pacific Northwest food guru John Rowley has always preached that getting great peaches. This is John's giving us all preached great peach. It's a tongue twisting question we got here. Has always preached that getting great peaches means never having to say they've been refrigerated. But I've never heard why chilling picked peaches screws up their final ripening process. Can you explain it? Also, I've heard different opinions about whether the sugar content in peaches goes up after they've been picked. What's the truth, John Riper in Seattle? I don't really know much about John Rowley, except I went to his website there, and he advocates using crappy white bread with tomato sandwiches so that the bread doesn't get in the way, and I wholeheartedly agree. I think you should use crappy white bread for, like, really good BLTs. You?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I freaking love BLTs, man. BLT is so delicious. Anyway.
Well, the Martin's white bread is good, too.
The potato bread?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I mean, that's, like, kind of the – well, okay, okay. What we mean is soft and gets out of the way fast. Yes, and so Martin's is kind of the – epitome of that style of soft and gets away, gets out of any, whatever. Okay. Okay, here it is. So, there is an interesting thing about this, and I read. So, I read a bunch of things. Oh, by the way, a shout out to @Quantastic on the Twitter, AJ @Quantastic, who tweeted to me. What do you say? Oh, yeah, she's Stas. That's a curse. It's a family program. A while back that he had some peaches that had what looked like some botrytis on them, the noble rot, and that they were amazingly delicious, I guess after some of the moisture had evaporated out after the botrytis. Anyway, he really liked them. And I found out that, in fact, botrytis on peaches is an issue, and they treat with fungicides. I like that word. Fungicide. You like that word, Stas?
No.
Because
you hate...
Yeah, anyway, fungicide. Anyway, so... some articles you might want to look at about this whole thing is interactions among cooling, fungicide, and post-harvest ripening temperature on peaches, 1999, and the influence of cooling and temperature maintenance on the quality of California-grown stone fruit, F.G. Mitchell, 1986. So here's the deal. There's a whole series of things in peaches called chilling injuries. And what happens is peaches are typically, if you want to ripen a peach, you want a peach to ripen at roughly 20 degrees Celsius, right? And peaches will ripen after they've picked. I'm assuming that they don't ripen the same way when they're picked as they would if you let them sit on the tree. But the fact of the matter is if you let them completely ripen until they soften on the tree, they can't be shipped at all. They're like one of the most fragile things that exists, right? So so you can't do it. So you can't commercially do that. I mean, if you have your own tree, you can do it, but you can't commercially do it. So the fruits, once they're picked, they want to be ripened at 20 degrees C. And what's going to happen is you're going to get probably an increase in Brix, an increase in total dissolved solids, and you get breakdown of the pectins because the fruit softens, and furthermore, there's probably a reduction in total acidity, right? And the creation of volatile flavor compounds for the ripening that you wouldn't get if you didn't let it ripen continue. Anyway, problem is, peaches are picked usually at like higher than 20 degrees Celsius because they're being picked out in the middle of an orchard in California when it's piss hot in the summertime, right? Piss hot. And so what you need to do is chill – commercially, what they do is they try to chill the peaches down very quickly when they get out of the orchard. Now, and they need to do that because – when they're warm and they're being handled and packed, they're much more apt to be bruised, destroyed, and the rot and fungus that come in out of the orchards and the different organisms, right, work very rapidly at those high temperatures. So they try to get the temperatures down as quickly as possible, and then if they're going to employ a fungicide or something else, they put it on when they're cooling it. Then after they've packed it and they're in a stable place where they've been packed, then prior to sale, they ripen them out at the higher temperatures, right? Let them go through their business. Problem is that peaches, when they're held at refrigeration temperature from like 4 degrees Celsius to like 10 degrees Celsius, in that range, when they're held there for a long period of time, they have what's called a chill injury such that they never ripen properly. And I tried to look through what causes this, and it's relatively unclear to me what the actual cause is, but it monkey wrenches the ripening process so that it never happens even after the fruit's been warmed up. Now, temporary chilling doesn't seem to have this effect, so that storage in the refrigerator for like a day or two, once you let it come back up, it might throw off the ripening, it might mess it up, but it's not going to prevent ripening from happening. Now, all right, let me finish this and we'll take the caller. So the interestingly, if you take the peaches all the way down to zero, but don't let them freeze in that very narrow window, like 0 to 2 degrees Celsius, they don't necessarily get those chill injuries. And also, if you take your peaches and they do what's called intermittent warming, so they have them in cold storage, and every couple of days they bring the ramp the temperature up to like to higher ripening temperature and then cool it back down again. If you do that, you can also stop what's called the chill injury. But it's a specific, it's a known thing with peaches, and they get what's called a woolly defect where there's almost no flavor, they don't soften right, and they taste kind of woolly and mealy. You like peaches that are woolly and mealy?
Oh, no.
It's the worst, right? Is there anything worse? Mm-mm. This is why I always get nectarines instead of peaches.
Me
because
too,
yeah, because the peaches we get here in New York, they suck. They suck.
And when you touch it and it's kind of soft, and then you're like, this is going to be good, but it's...
It never is. Where for some reason, they do a much better job getting nectarines to us here in the market. Mm-hmm. All right, caller, you're on the air.
Hi, Dave. This is Steven from Indianapolis again. Hey. I called about 2 weeks ago for the neutropenic question.
Oh, yeah. So what was the upshot? What happened?
It ends up that the hospital has extremely strict rules, and no matter what I give her, I have to microwave it beforehand anyways. So, which I think is kind of crap, but, I mean, that's the way it goes. I got the yogurt answer, though.
Oh, what was it?
A pathogen, or a bacteria in your gut is different than a bacteria in your blood. And if, since we have a line of defense in our blood, which is our neutrophils, that bacteria, the immune response will take care of it, which she can't do. So, I mean, a gut bacteria is not necessarily okay to have in your blood. So if it can get into your blood. So that's the reason I got, I also had another doctor tell me that they would give their patients yogurt if they could, if the hospital would allow it. So, I mean, it's still kind of it seems like a gray area, but that's an answer that I received.
So what I'm feeling from what you're saying is that hospital policy is super draconian to make sure nothing happens, but the doctor says it's – yeah. The only problem with this, I think as we discussed last time, is that it turns out that patient outcome is better if they like the food that they're eating.
Yeah, definitely. My mom is a person that's in the hospital, and she just – like she won't eat the hospital food. It's crap. So we end up cooking her soups and stuff that hold up well with the microwaving, and she eats that well.
Right. And by the way, what you're pointing out is something that I think cooks, a lot of institutional cooks and even cooks in general, and you've hit the nail on the head with this, is that if you have a set of parameters that are unvarying, right, I have to cook the crap out of this, then only choose foods that survive that well. Don't try to make things that can't have the crap cooked out of them and still taste good. Like for instance, like I don't know whether you guys can deal with salt. I don't know what the salt issues are with the diet, but like confit would be great.
Okay, yeah, definitely, because you can nuke the hell out of that and it's fine.
Yeah, you can beat
I can't say that on
there. No, that's fine. No, that's good. But yeah, you can cook the ever-loving. Yeah, you can cook. It's meant to be cooked that way. So people often make the mistake of trying to cook things that can't be cooked given a certain set of parameters and doing it well. And then serving that. Why? There are plenty of things out there that taste good when they've been cooked to death, you know?
Right. Well, and it seems like a lot of the parameters that are laid out by the hospital for the average, for the average family that, you know, they don't have a family member that's super into the science behind cooking. So, like, shellfish is one of the things that they can't have, and I believe that that's because of what you discussed a while ago, enterotoxins that could be present in seafood that's not treated well,
right,
or something like that. So they pretty much just assume that the patients aren't going to prepare it as well as they should, is what I'm assuming. And so, yeah, you're right. They're very hypersensitive to it.
Right, but that's the thing. So that's when you have to put on kind of an engineer's mindset. You know, I got plenty of engineers in my family, so it's easy for me to do. You put on the engineer's mindset, you're like, well, let's not think about, you know, we have a set of givens. What are the set of givens? Now, what's the best we can do within that set of givens, you know, rather than wishing that you could make something that you can't make within your set of givens. You know what I'm saying? And I think and it's real. It's actually very good practice for cooking in general because every moment in your life, I guess no matter what you're doing, but I think mainly about the kitchen, you always have a set of limitations that you have to deal with, and your ability to do the best possible job with the limitations you have determine how good you are as a cook. You know what I mean?
Definitely. I completely agree. I know you don't have a lot of time, so do you mind if I ask you the question real quick?
Sure.
But I came on the air to ask you another question. I was curious about the transglutaminase and the noodles that Wiley Dufresne makes. You said that he does like transglutaminase and gelatin noodles.
Yep.
I noticed that I was looking through the types of transglutaminase to get, because I know you do Activa RM most of the time, which has the casein, I believe, right?
Yep.
Okay. One of them has gelatin in it. And I was curious if it did not cross-link or it did not solidify because the concentration of gelatin was so low that they're not actually interacting that well.
Well, there's two, at least last time I checked, there were two different transglutaminases. Meat glue, by the way, for those that don't know what we're talking about. It's what, you know, bonds proteins together covalently, actually. There's two different, and the enzyme is transglutaminase, and typically there's a helper protein in it that that is used kind of to bridge the gaps between what would otherwise be two pieces of meat that on a molecular level are fairly far apart. Okay, so in the one that's most commonly used by chefs is called Activa RM, and it's transglutaminase mixed with casein, milk protein. There are two, or were at least last time I checked, two different transglutaminases that had gelatin as a component. There was GB, which stands for greatest bond, and that's been around for a long time. And a lot of the reason that you know, Nils and I never recommended using that one is because it kind of sets up tacky pretty quickly, and it's hard to reposition. So, and we didn't necessarily need that huge bond strength that comes from the GB. Because it does cross-link. The other one that we used, and so I don't know anyone that keeps GB around. The other one is called GS, and GS is one that has gelatin in it that also has phosphates in it that's designed to sit on the counter as a slurry because the enzyme doesn't work until it's been painted on the meat because the phosphates in it keep it too alkaline for the enzymes to work properly. So, yeah, they will cross-link, but what you want, I don't know what the specific gelatin characteristics are of the ones that are in GB and GS. Wiley's recipe, he says you can use RM, but I'm almost 100% sure that he uses Activa TI, which is just Activa, and maltodextrin with no helper protein in it. And the reason why is we've had failure of his recipe when we use RM because you actually don't want the gelatin bonding to anything but itself. Okay, so if there's casein protein, if there's casein in there, or other proteins that the stuff's bonding to when you're making these kind of vegetable-based gelatin noodles, we ended up not getting the awesome gelatin cross-linking because a lot of the gelatin was cross-linking to other things. At least that's our theory. So we always had much better results with that his gelatin recipe when you use TI. So what he would do is he would hydrate the gelatin. He would make this puree, very low moisture content purees. He would then hydrate, you know, regular gelatin. I don't know what he used, like Nox or equivalent. Nox is fairly high bloom strength. Make the slurry, let that cool down a little bit, add the TI to that, and then mix the whole thing together, spread it, and let it set. And that's, you know, really what he's looking for is the cross-linking of gelatin there. Am I answering the question or no?
No, you're completely answering the question. One more part to it. I'm sure you're running out of time. But has he ever done time-based studies? Have you ever done time-based transglutaminase reactions with gelatin to see, like, the relative rates of cross-linkage to see, like, if it the melting point just increases over time, or is that...
I'm sure it does, because ultimate strength increases over time, so you get like 75% of your bond strength in the first 4 hours. However, you get a lot more if you let it sit overnight, so I'm pretty sure Wiley does his day before.
Polymerize as much as possible, right?
Yeah, right. And it's the same with a lot of hydrocolloids, actually. Gel strength changes, and it's not the same, but in hydrocolloids as well, gel strength changes over time, which is why they make the pimento strips in the center of olives are made from alginate, and they age those for a day because their gel strength changes dramatically, and whether or not they're going to snap changes dramatically after they've been aged for a day. So a lot of these polymerization reactions have the majority of the thing happens fairly quickly, but then there are continued changes for a long period of time afterwards.
Okay, and just one more question. Is there any way that, like, maybe next time or whatever, you could talk about, like, good articles and stuff that talk about, like, food polymerization reactions and relative, like, what I'm curious about is hydration rates to see how the gel is affected by different hydration,
on gelatin in particular?
I'm actually interested in hydrocolloids in general.
Yeah, I'll come up with some good references, and some that are like partially, and we'll give them a shout out, or I'll tweet them out during the week or something like that. We'll give them a shout out next week. If you can remember to send in the question about it to like the email, then it'll help us not forget.
Perfect, I'll do that. Thanks a lot.
Cool, thank you. Jason Bazant writes in, pronounce as you would Van Zant, so I guess Bazant. Bazant. Pronounce as you would Van Zant. I like that. Now I'm thinking of the E Street Band. Okay. Jason Bazant writes in about high notes and cooking potatoes. I'm your biggest fan. I think I can make a good case for this assertion. More later. For now, I've heard you talk about the high notes and bass notes, etc., when talking about flavor and various preparations. I love this analogy as I'm a musician, but I'm yet to fully appreciate what this means when it comes to putting a dish together. Are you able to outline the origins of this type of thinking? I imagine it's ultimately a matter of balancing across the whole spectrum, acid, bitter, sweet, sour, etc. It sounds like it's more applicable to beverages than, say, dishes, but I'm not sure. I'm a savory guy when it comes to cooking. Can you talk about this, please? And second, I'll just mention both things, then we'll go into them. This way, I have to answer them both, right? My wife cubed a bunch of potatoes and cooked it in the microwave with water until tender, and then let it completely cool, much to my chagrin, prior to mashing. Her idea was to make mash for our 18-month-old son. Now, I know how to make a mashed potato. Face-punchably, so I guess he's punching himself in the face as his wife is doing this. I feel for you, brother. I noticed her mashing the cold potato with a fork into a total gloop, hoping for a good result. I pointed out to her some starch basics. Bad idea. Your note, not mine. But it also, obviously, it's a bad idea. When someone is doing something horrible in the kitchen, like, unless you are literally their boss, it's, like, really a bad idea to tell them what they're doing is horrifying. You know what I'm saying? Because, but you can't hide it. You can't hide it. The look on your face of horror cannot be hid. And then they ask.
The worst is when you buy the food and take it to somebody's house
and they ruin your food.
You
know, here's the worst, because you hate it. You know how to do it. And then they look at you and they can tell that you want to kill. You don't want to kill your wife. You know what I'm saying? They can tell that you're upset. You know what I mean? And then they ask you, what's wrong? And you can't lie and say nothing's wrong, because you're looking at them and, like, everything that you feel as a person says that what they're doing is horribly destructive to the quality of the food that otherwise was cared for quite well until it reached their hands and was destroyed, right? But it turns out that when you do that to your spouse, bad things happen. I know. This is why my wife won't cook with me, ever. She says I'm an a-hole in the kitchen. That, her words. Anyway. So I pointed out there were some starch basics, and she threw up her hands and said, you fix it then, and promptly went to bed. All I wanted to do was throw it out, but then I thought, I'll ask Dave. Obviously, this glooped-out mash deserves to be thrown away, but can you think of any reasonable culinary application for such a ridiculous preparation? All right, we'll go in reverse. By the way, can I go a little bit late today, guys?
No.
All right, I got to wrap this up. Okay.
Unfortunately.
So so we'll go in reverse. So the potatoes, as mashed potatoes, are pretty much ruined, right? They're done. But you can mix them into things like croquettes if you're frying things out, or we were just talking about it, Martin's potato bread. Potato bread is a good use for old mashed potatoes, right, Stas?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I wouldn't do gnocchi. Gnocchi, I would want it fresh. Wouldn't you want it fresh from gnocchi? But potato bread you could probably get away with. But here's another interesting point that you might want to think about. Nils Noren, used to work with for years at the French Culinary, who's a monster cook. He used to make a mashed potato, like a glue, on purpose. And it's part of this whole thing that McGee talks about, I talk about, Nils talks about. If you push something that is a defect so far in the defect direction, sometimes it comes around to being good again. So he would overcook potatoes, then add extra liquid to them, if you can imagine this, then blend them in a VitaPrep to shatter all the starch granules and turn it into kind of a pasty glue, and then flavor it. And the idea was to accentuate that potato puree with that kind of interesting kind of gluey texture, not try to have it be mashed potatoes at all. And I got to say, it's pretty good. Now, your starch is probably retrograded somewhat, especially if it's old, so it's not going to maybe work the same way. But you could try just pushing the glue all the way, reheat the hell out of it, add extra liquid to turn it into a glue, or use it in the use it that other way. Now, as to the high notes, I'm getting the high sign. Listen. I'm gonna answer this first thing on the next program. I'm also gonna answer Jacob's question about burr grinders and coffee. I'm gonna answer David's question about muffin style mixing, and I'm gonna talk to Dan D about recreating recipes from the Applebee's appetizer menu. Anyway, next time on Cooking Issues.
Thanks for listening to this program on heritageradionetwork.org. You can find all of our archived programs on our website or as podcasts in the iTunes store by searching Heritage Radio Network. You can like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can email us questions at any time at info@heritageradionetwork.org. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization. To donate and become a member, visit our website today. Thanks for listening.